another Women of Letters podcast. I'm Jules from the Super Wiki, and along with me here I have Amy.
Yep, hi, I'm Amy. I'm also known as Sweet Undine, and today Jules and I are going to look at the first two episodes back from Hiatus. So we have Road Trip and Firstborn to look at today, and we decided to wait to see what happened in Firstborn because Road Trip kind of left us all up in the air, hanging and emotionally devastated. So,
which was only compounded by Firstborn. I think we're actually now feeling a little overwhelmed at everything we have to cover. It feels like those two episodes. When I think back, there is so much in there, both in terms of character and in terms of plot and new mythology. It almost feels like sort of half a dozen episodes of story rather than just two, which is not a complaint, dear Supernatural writers. It's a compliment.
No, they were both absolutely fantastic episodes. And I'm laughing because every time a new episode hits the air, I go, oh, this one's my favourite one. It's my favourite of the season. It's like, along with the 10 other ones, because I just feel like every single episode is just so good this season. And these last two have been fantastic.
I'd have to say, well, I was calling Road Trip my favourite of the season, but I think Firstborn has certainly taken that spot without contest at the moment. I mean, you always need a bit of distance, and we've still got another 12 episodes to go. So it's an early call, but I think... if you were going to demonstrate to anyone what an amazing show this is, let alone for one in its ninth season, these two episodes certainly demonstrate a show which I'd put up against anything on TV in terms of every aspect of it.
And a tight season. It's been, you know, like a really tight, cohesive. The flow has been great from one episode on to the next. There's been nothing that has felt like a little out of place or, well, you know, we could have done without that one. Every single one has seemed to have a reason to be. And, you know, as you say, in the ninth season, it's really quite an achievement to actually notch it up and, you know, sort of raise the level.
I think part of that tightness too comes from... I compare it a bit. The seasons I tend to like the most are the ones that have the tighter, tighter's not a good word, tend to have a very present mythology throughout them. And season four is probably an excellent example of that. So you don't have those as many episodes where the main myth arc can be ignored. So, for example, in season five, you didn't feel like Lucifer was round the corner every moment. You know, there were episodes went past where that Lucifer wasn't particularly a concern. Now, that's not a criticism because some of my favourite episodes are in season five, but season four, and I think here in season nine and to some extent season eight, there's no breathing space. You know, even the sort of Monster of the Week episodes, you've still had, you know, Crowley in the basement, and you've still had knowing that, you know, Ezekiel/Gadriel was in Sam. So it's almost claustrophobic in that you could never get away from the pressing issues at hand. There's no space for either the boys or for us to sort of just go off and have a romp for a week. It's always been there, and I think that keeps the tension up through the season in a way that's really satisfying, but also frazzling as well.
It is excellent. I am tense, let's just say that. Keeping the tension up, yes, they're doing it with me, and you know, I don't think we're going to be romping for a while, quite frankly. But yeah, exactly. I think the wonderful thing is, like you said, that the mythology has been ever present, and there really hasn't been an episode that's gone through this season where there hasn't been at least a nod to it somewhere, where a mention or a flash of, you know, Gadriel's eyes or or something or Crowley or something happening. There's always been just a little bit of a hint of the mythology, even if this episode seems standalone, there was a tie through. And we do have had, when we have had seasons in the past where we would go several episodes without it even mentioning the big story. And this season, no. This season it's been woven and threaded through every single episode. And I think it, as you say, it's just what's made it very, very powerful and even more hard. Heart-wrenching and stressful, and you know, like, and it leaves you gagging every single week. You know, like, you're not kind of going, oh well, that was a cute episode, what's next week? It's like, oh my god, what's gonna happen? Because it's like it's pulling you from one to the next every single week, which is just fantastic. And you know, you can't help but be as proud of Punch of the show, you know, of this caliber that we love this much in this late in the day, turning out the quality of material that they're turning out, as you say, from every single aspect of production.
And we should mention, because a couple of things have happened since we were last on air. So one of them was the Television Critics Association. I think we might have mentioned this briefly last time, where the CW president, Mark Pedowitz, actually said, you know, Supernatural can keep going as long as the boys want to keep doing it and the ratings are good.
Yes, so, he's a fanboy, you got to love him.
Yes, and so we know that Jared and Jensen are contracted for season 10 if it's picked up by the CW, and obviously there are strong signs that that's likely to happen. But a Variety published an article this week because the episode this week, Firstborn, had the highest ratings since the season 6 premiere, so in 4 years. The highest, I think it was, you know, 2.7 million viewers. Yeah. And I think the highest rating in God knows how long for I think it was teenage girls, I think.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
1.6, which is like unheard of. they mentioned that, you know, Supernatural would be filming its 200th episode early in the 10th season, which has been renewed. But as I've a number of us have said many times on Twitter, the renewal is not official as yet. It can happen any time, probably between February and May. Last year we got, I think it was the earliest renewal notice ever in early February, so fingers crossed that it's again. I think I'd be shocked, maybe for the first time ever this year, if we didn't get renewed. Oh. But television is television.
Yeah, it is an expensive show to make, and I think that would probably be the only kind of sticking point. But I don't doubt. I mean, when you look at articles saying that the CW had the best Tuesday night that they've had since 2005, and when you
basically since it started,
yeah, it's like with the original
because it only started. Well, no. 2006, because the CW only started in
2006. Oh, well, it must have been 2006, sorry. Yeah, so that's, you know, that's fantastic. And also, Supernatural's actually the only ongoing drama, not in the new dramas, but the only ongoing returning drama that has actually increased audience this year.
Yeah. And
by like 14% year on year.
Yeah, so look, all the signs are excellent for a season 10. Beyond that, who knows? But let's just hold our breath and hope for a official announcement soon. My little bit of superstition is I will never put up an episode entry on the Super Wiki for the next season until there's an official announcement.
That's great. So, I think that's great.
hopefully that'll be soon. But look, let's get right into talking about Road Trip. So we had this came back obviously after the end of year hiatus. Which had ended, of course, on an incredible note with Gadriel in Sam's body killing Kevin and basically hijacking, kidnapping Sam and leaving devastated Dean next to Sam's body. And so we started up this episode, Road Trip, this year, basically straight after that with a very moving scene of Kevin's body being given a hunter's funeral pyre by Dean, and
it was beautiful. And well, I think what made it really beautiful was that they had the Bob Seger song playing through it, but they had no, once he got into the bunker, there was no other sound but the music, and I actually thought that was made it so powerful, because when he's when Dean was throwing things off the table and tossing chairs across the room, and just that sheer absolute devastation in his face as he threw the phone after looking at the photo of Kevin and his mom, you know, and there was nothing but music, and that was just such a beautifully powerful scene. And I thought that
before that, when he's looking around at where Kevin's body was, and Kevin's notes, and his half-eaten sandwich, and I I've often said that one of the standouts for me is how Supernatural has the narrative of grief on Supernatural, and it's never just someone dies and, oh, we're sad or revengeful or we get on with it. And I think, you know, you saw in Dean then you saw grief, you saw rage, you saw, you know, a whole mix of emotions there. And obviously Kevin's death continued to be a strong through line in this week's episode as well. But, yeah, it was a very, very powerful, beginning to that episode. And then, of course, we have Cass back. Arrives back with Dean having called him back in the trench coat, which
a new
I have
trench
to say,
coat. I quite like this one. I think this one's a little sharper.
It's on point for fashion. Let me go into my Tim Gunn mode. the shorter length is on point for fashion. I'm a bit torn whether I prefer this one over the old one. Was your classic European?
You look like Columbo in the old one.
I tend to think sort of more European or noir detective type trench coat. A bit more fashionable. It's a pity we didn't get the scene where Cass goes shopping for a shirt. For a suit and a trench coat.
He's a little bit more casual now, though. He doesn't have the tie anymore. So
no. And I think someone I read commented, and I don't know if that was in an intent, but in a way, it's nice to have the familiarity. He's moved back to being an angel. He has taken on his, if you like, uniform of being an angel. But there is a change, and that's, of course, been a theme through both episodes of how Cass has been changed with the experience of being human. So I think that's a good point, and whether that was on purpose by the wardrobe department or not, and whether he will buy a tie or Dean will get him one for his angels have birthdays.
I don't know. But I think he's looking pretty sharp, and I agree. I actually really love that when he reverted to his angelic state, he went back to his old outfit. I would have hated to see him running around in jeans and t-shirt or a hoodie or something, you know, like he was doing before, because it just wouldn't feel right. So I thought it was a really good move on behalf of the show to bring back a familiar outfit, but also realistically make it, because he left that other coat in the laundromat, so you know, realistically make him look like he had to go and get new gear. And also, I'm sure Mish is happy because this stuff's going to fit him, and he always said the other outfit never fitted him because he was only supposed to be on for two episodes.
Yes,
so he's always wearing this huge suit.
So yes, nice to see him a bit sharper. I mean, there is a whole, just to go on a tangent for a moment, there's a whole conversation to be had around how and I know people have written measure around how most of the angels do always present in suits or sort of corporate gear. So in that way, it's also in keeping with, what's become emblematic of being an angel is suiting up. And I think there's a whole other conversation around why angels aren't more cash, but... we'll leave that and get back to the episode. Now, of course, in the ultimate of ironies, this episode, you know, filmed late last year and written, you know, probably in the middle of last year, features Gadriel killing a Justin Bieber-esque pop star.
Yeah.
And, of course, it happened to air the same day that one Mr. Padalecki made a comment on Twitter about certain Mr. Bieber, who's had some issues and of late and been in the news. So a case of life imitating art, imitating life, I think.
Also strange.
Yes, it was. Yes, timing. Mm-hmm. Maybe Justin's really a Supernatural fan.
Maybe.
Who knows?
That would be hilarious.
And then, of course, we get the having to start the deal with the devil and getting Crowley on side and going on the eponymous road trip of the episode.
Do you know what I really loved? I really loved that the car that Cass stole was the same colour as his trench coat. I think it was a comfort thing.
And I love that I think originally on the wiki we just called it Cass's car or something, but obviously the name Pimpmobile took root in fandom very quickly, and someone came on and made sure that the page was renamed Cass's Pimpmobile.
Oh, bless.
I wish we had a scene of Cass actually driving the Pimpmobile at one point.
That was quite fascinating.
There is a question of when Cass actually learned how to drive.
I know, I was the same. I was like, Cass has been driving. When did he learn? Does he have a license?
And the added question of, given he'd been working at a gas station, didn't understand that cars would run out of gas. But there you go. Cass is a complex and quirky character. And we did have the absolutely delicious scene of Crowley and Cass fighting over who got to ride shotgun.
And Crowley flirting with Cass, which I'm so in love with how Crowley just flirts with everybody. I just love it. But yeah, I loved it. And Dean's face, and Dean like yelling like a dad in the front. He nearly was almost said, I'm going to pull this over, you know.
And I think, look, that's something both these episodes, and probably particularly Road Trip, both of them, in balancing that lightness and humour, because they've been very dark in terms of content and plot. And I think it's a real talent to be able to have those little moments without pulling you out of the gravity of the situation, or without it feeling that the characters are suddenly out of character for that situation. And I suppose it's a bit iconic for Supernatural, really, that they've always managed to do that. But I just think it's something that really makes the show stand out, so that you can have this moment that, you know, we're still laughing about, but in no way did it detract or make it feel like they weren't taking the situation seriously. And of course, at the same time, you have the woman who's a demon watching them, that ties into the Abaddon part of the storyline, and her later killing poor Muffins to use in her blood phone.
Which I know, I was like, oh no, no, poor Muffins.
Well, someone pointed out maybe it wasn't Muffin's blood. Maybe she killed a neighbour, but, you know.
Well, I'd feel better about that, quite frankly.
Oh, no, Muffin's had to go. Sorry.
Oh, poor Muffins. Oh, no, I actually did that. I was like, oh, no, she killed the dog. Humans, whatever. Oh, my gosh. And then, of course, we have them. I love the scene where the three of them are sitting on the seat waiting to go in for their appointment.
Yes.
And they're just, the three of them are just sitting there. It's like the most unlikely trio. It's just so lovely. I really loved the three of them joining up together to go on that road trip. It was just ridiculous, really, but just awesome to watch.
And it's probably it's a strange point to mention it, because it's not a big moment, but it's a very high shot we get looking down on them with the glass in the background. And, of course, it was a Bob Singer-directed episode, and I love his directing, particularly the character side of things. But that, again, is just a little point of the moment they made out of what could just be a very ordinary shot, as you say. The humour is just in the way it's framed. You don't need to say anything. Again, it's the visual is selling a joke, if you like, through the directing. And I think it was, there's a lot of bigger and more glamorous and effective moments of Bob Singer's directing in the episode you can talk about. But that I think it's, or some of the little ones that that really take it that next level as well. And then we have the wonderful Cecily and her
the Castiel her appreciation, fan girl.
Her appreciation of Feathery Castiel, which was.
Oh my goodness, yeah. She was a Castiel fangirl. And I was wondering, I did actually wonder what the intent was of that scene. Like, just because there was a lot of exposition around what happened to Castiel being relayed to Crowley. And I was wondering if that's something that's going to come back later, the whole stealing the grace thing that he's now aware of and all that kind of thing, because I was like, well, why is she telling him all of this? And I guess, you know, there's an element of the fact that they're both being touched by humanity and they're both, you know, have this lingering humanity now within them, or, you know, the remnants of their exposure to humanity.
I think look, purely on a practical level, you need Crowley to be brought up to date.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't make sense for either, you know, Dean or Cass to be telling him the whole story, because, you know, they're only going to tell him what he needs to know. I suppose, you know, you could have had a scene where Cass does, because we know in the past Cass is, you know, although he's less likely to with Crowley. So I think you probably really needed an ally to get Crowley up to date.
Yeah.
Otherwise you're going to be tripping over the fact, you know, in a writing sense, tripping over the fact that Crowley doesn't know what's been going on over the next few episodes, and Dean would have been having to say, oh, yes, that's because.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So in one way, I think you're right, there's sort of bigger thematic links and purpose as well, but I think some of it's purely practical.
Practical exposition.
Let's get this guy up to date. And also, you know, I think quite well worked in on then how Abaddon gets the information about, you know, Crowley being out and what's up to date. So poor now dead Cecily was a good good link, you know, a good way for Abaddon to get that message, rather than just the normal, you know, having demons stalk them all the time. So
she was also dumb as a housebreak, what she said to Abaddon. I was like, oh, gosh, well, no wonder you ended up getting stabbed with an angel blade, because.
Well, but, I mean, again, to it pointed out, I thought that brought up some of the, you know, again, some of the differences between Crowley and Abaddon, so that, you know, that they are very different in that, you know, Crowley can go, oh, yes, certainly that's what I would do, would be play both sides, whereas Abaddon's like, well, you're either on my side or you're not, so you're dead.
Yeah.
So
Crowley has a lot more nuance than Abaddon, I think.
Well,
he's a people demon.
Or a demon. And, you know,
yes, more like.
I think this might be a long bow to draw, which suddenly sounds like an Arrow reference, but.
Love that show.
Sorry, I've just watched this week's Arrow.
Oh, I haven't watched it yet.
What was I going to say? It draws on the fact that for why Crowley has not killed the Winchesters many years ago or since. And that's the fact that he's always looking to exploit the, you know, what someone might be able to do for him, if not now, in the future. So, you know, his assessment of Cecily is she's given him some good information, got him up to date, helped out. She's talking to Abaddon. That might be of use to him. So, you know, she goes in the bank as, you know, not a big enough threat to kill, possibly useful, whereas Abaddon's just like, you're not loyal, you're out of here. So, again, you know, and I think people have often mentioned, you know, why didn't Crowley kill the Winchesters, excuse me, years ago? And I think part of that, so we can still have Mark Shepherd on the show. And
yeah, which, thank goodness, he's a treasure.
But I think it's also because Crowley likes life to be interesting, but also because the Winchesters have proved to be tools for him.
Yeah, he's a politician. And
occasionally tools when they're dealing with him.
Yes, well, yes, but he can be a tool in return. And to be honest, I also think he likes them, but, you know, much to his chagrin, I'm pretty sure he likes Moose and Squirrel.
I think he likes Moose in particular in a slightly special way.
He does like Moose.
But, yeah, and, you know, of course we see that in the next episode, Dean is, you know, the whole point of it is that he can manipulate and use Dean. So, making a lot out of Cecily's very brief appearance. And she was, of course, nice little shout-out, named after Cecily Schaefer, who's Jeremy Carver's assistant. So,
there you go.
Always nice for people to get show people to get a shout out on the name. And I'll mention now, in case I forget later on, that Tara the Hunter in Firstborn was, of course, named after Tara Larson, who works in production in Vancouver. So, and had an extra little shout out because Tara Larson's always talking about food and her posting her food porn photos, and you would have seen that Tara the Hunter had a bento box of sushi.
Yep.
Which is a nice little touch. So we then get where are we up to?
Well, I guess we get to Gadriel and Metatron hooking up.
Looking up in the plotting the downfall of the universe sense rather than the...
Yes, the other sense.
Hitting the mattress.
Than the fan fiction sense. Yes. It was really interesting to see Gadriel's old vessel tending bar there.
Oh, look, a beautiful way. Now, I know
I was so excited about that.
I have this thing where I hold my hand up when the credit's coming on at the beginning. I just hold my hand up so I don't see any actors who are going to be in the episode that I don't want to know about. And this was something we didn't know before the episode. It hadn't been in any of the spoilers at the time.
I didn't see his credit either.
No. Well, I didn't because I was covering it up, but it is
I
there.
I didn't because I wasn't paying attention, obviously.
I think a lot of fans had loved his performance at the beginning of the season so well and were sort of thinking, wow, he's gone now, what a waste. So it was an absolute delight to see him back. And, of course, I didn't actually quite click at first that he was the bartender. I sort of did a double take after a couple of seconds, pointing and sort of screaming wordlessly at the screen.
I think I made like some noise like, ah! Oh my gosh, because I was really excited because I was the same. I really liked him on when we first met him in the first episode of the season, and I was like, oh, bummer, man, he's gone already, and I kept thinking maybe he'll come back. And Carver, in his non-teasing, non-spoilery, spoiler-phobic way, sort of danced around it. But I was like so excited when I saw him in the bar because I obviously wasn't paying attention in the opening credits, so I was watching what was going on probably and not watching actually the names popping up, which is usually my way. And so I didn't know, so I thought that was really exciting.
Yeah, just because you didn't know what it was going to mean. I mean, it could have been anything. So
but I assumed as soon as I saw him, I was like, oh, he's gonna pop back straight into that guy at some point tonight in this episode. Woohoo!
And so, of course, Gadriel finally gets captured after a well-placed punch to the face by Cass.
Because I was really wondering how they were going to capture him. I was like, I guess Cass just knocked him out. But
yes. Well, of course, we do have the advantage still, and that he can't, the angels can't teleport. So
this is true. That
does make them a little, vulnerable. A little easier to capture if you can get them off guard, so they can't just zap out.
Just on Gadriel, a lot of people have been asking me, and I've had a lot of comments about his friend. What was his friend's name?
Abner.
How Abner had a slashed throat, and there's been I know that there's been a lot of sort of chit chat about whether, because we never actually saw him angel blade him out, as to whether whether he did a deal with Abner or something like that, or whether Abner had been killed by the angel blade because his throat was cut, not just jabbed. I mean, I think Abner's dead, but I just thought I'd ask you what you thought.
I think he's dead.
Yeah, mate.
Basically, I didn't.
I kept going to him. I think he's dead. I think the dude's dead.
I think it was just
a more dramatic shot to have his throat cut and lots of blood everywhere.
Stabbed in the gut. Yeah,
and to be honest, that's a much more. I mean, I think that for me also, To have Gadriel do that to a friend, which is a much more impactful death to actually cut someone's throat, you know, than just like give him a jab. It's a really personal, up close and personal way to kill somebody.
The only thing I could think of as an possible alternative is that he killed the vessel and not the angel, so that Abner's now. As we know, some of the angels are who haven't got vessels floating. Incorporeal, and that he may reappear in another vessel at a later time. So perhaps, maybe the intent was for us to take the implication that Gadriel still felt strong enough connection to Abner to not actually want to kill him, but to kill the vessel. I think that's overthinking it, but I could accept that that could have been the intent. But I think you're right, it was just. Let's have him with his throat slashed.
Yeah, and when I started to sort of overanalyze it, it looked like a much bigger line that Gadriel crossed. To actually cut the throat of a friend.
I think there was that
him over to some other dark place that he.
Yes, because there was that whole point of the scene where Abner's saying. Where it becomes clear because Gadriel doesn't kill him in the first moment, he comes back after the family's out, that you're feeling is there some empathy, sympathy here, that there's a reluctance on Gadriel's part and that as you say, he then somehow pushes through that and, again... again, goes to an even for him an even darker place. So yeah, I think that's probably it. And then
they caught him.
And then they catch him and take him to conveniently located, dungeon with a dentist chair.
Did they carry that chair with them? Because like that was I was like, did they pop the chair in the car?
Oh, no. Obviously, and Crowley has these places set up. All over the Midwest. If the guy's got a warehouse full of Kraken essence in Belize, I quite easily believe there's torture chambers in every town.
Thought of you when we heard that. I was like, I'm thinking of you.
yes, I noticed some people are like, oh, that's definitely a shout out to you.
I was like, ooh, I'll take it where I can get it. But the leather stuff all had warding on it and the stuff around his face and everything. I was like, where are they? But anyway, yes.
Well, they certainly could have taken
that with them.
Things that they bound him with.
In that duffel.
Garrett commented that the leather face restraint did cut into his lip, poor darling.
I don't want that.
So yes, they could have taken that with him, and I mean, you now get into quite a really uncomfortable scene to watch, where we have where we have them getting Crowley to tap into Gadriel's programming, if you will, which involves sticking large needles in Sam's head.
And it was a really horrible scene to watch, and I was like, Dean, I didn't want to watch it. But what I really found amazing about this scene and most of the scenes, and probably all the scenes of Gadriel, Ezekiel, whatever, was that I actually never saw Sam when I was watching those scenes.
Yeah.
Just never once. That character was such a different character to me, even though he was physically Sam.
Yeah.
I just never ever saw him, and he was.
Well, it's a bit like when Sam was playing Soulless Sam. I mean, it was quite, and that was, I suppose, even more subtle. But still, I don't think anyone had any difficulty in accepting it being a totally different character. And the case here is just, it's been quite extraordinary how he's been able to morph into. I suppose it's called acting, isn't it?
Acting, is that what it's called? he's doing a good job at it anyway. It was really good. And Gadriel turned out to be just horrible, really, in that moment. I was like, oh, he's kind of not very nice. Maybe that's why he was locked up for eternity.
Well, yes. I'll be interested to see what more we actually find out about Gadriel.
Because he has seemed to have crossed over... he's kind of gone from, for me, he went from a character where I was like, I could kind of understand his pain, and he looked really conflicted at every single turn of all the stuff he had to do. And I had a feeling maybe there was a redemption story there for him, but he seemed to just massively cross some line in this episode where he went a little bit more villainous. Now, maybe there's still a redemption story for him, but for me, he went way darker than we'd seen him before. And I wasn't sure if, we're actually seeing the true him, and he's just been playing Dean all this time, which we know he was doing, but, you know, actually playing nicer. Or he's just put on his protection. Because, you know, I was like, just get out of Sam, man. You've been busted. And I guess he was staying in there because he figures he's safe in there because Dean's not going to kill him, and he knows now Dean's going to hunt him down and kill him. But I was like, you're so busted. Just why are you bothering to stay there and get needles stuck into your angel brain? If
Well, he couldn't get away.
Well, that's true. But he could say, I'll go. I mean, he did. He got out.
Yes, okay, at the end he did.
And they didn't take that chin thingy off him. That's true. So he did get out. So he could get out if he wanted to. Or he could have said, all right, just release me and I'll leave. And I mean, my only thing I could think of was the only reason he was staying is because he assumed that if he stayed in that physical form, that Dean Winchester would not hunt him down and stab him. But I'm not so sure about that, because Dean was pretty up for that at the beginning of the
episode. They had actually taken, now I don't know where the warding was, but they had actually taken the chin strap off.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
It was on the chin strap.
Okay, no, they take it. I'm looking at a photo now of when Gadriel leaves Sam's body and he doesn't have the chin strap on.
But he was just so belligerent, you know, and I was just like, get out. What are you doing?
And I thought, so we have the partway through while Crowley's working on Sam/Gadriel and Dean walks away. I thought a really significant scene where he apologises to, well, first of all, he just wants to be distracted from Sam being tortured, but that he actually apologises to Cass for not telling him what was going on and not trusting him. And I thought that was really significant.
I liked that whole scene a lot. I love that Dean just said, "Hey, going, man, you know, and just, you know, humor me, tell me, because I just want to hear anything but my brother screaming right now." I thought that scene between Dean and Cass was really, really lovely. And I so appreciated him sort of apologizing there, because I'm, you know, he never felt good about it, and we know that, and he never felt like it was the right thing to do, but it was the only thing he could do in that moment. He did what he had to do. Seems to be the theme of the season. I thought that was a lovely scene. And I have to say that this episode and Firstborn, I've just absolutely loved Castiel in both.
Oh, I think they're two of my favourite Cass episodes.
Just beautiful.
For a long time. And I thought the nice parallel, because we have then Cass saying to Dean, well, you know, I was tricked. You know, Dean says, I was deceived and tricked by Gadriel. And, of course, Cass says, well, you know, I was deceived and tricked by Metatron. And Dean has the line of, you know, we're a couple of dumb asses. And
no.
Cass is like, less of the dumb, less of the ass.
I know.
No, that was Dean.
Lovely.
Sorry. It's about trust.
Yeah.
And then he had a similar scene this week, you know, with Sam about we're both royally fucked up. But.
Yeah.
We can move beyond that. And I think seeing this, they felt like really, what the word, like really genuine moments of honesty and connection between these three characters, or, you know, between Cass and Dean and Cass and Sam, that, you know, are rare, because normally they are in the midst of things and they don't often get, it's not often these chances to clear the decks, if you like, and have those conversations at all.
Yeah.
And then sort of people to have those conversations. So
they were wonderful, because even though there was, like, both of the scenes had these massively traumatic things happening in them, they were both very quiet moments.
Yes.
And, yeah, I love them too. I really love that scene. And same with Firstborn, the stuff between Cass and Sam as well. I just was like, oh, man, I'm so glad. You know, like, if this is what being human and working at the Gas and Sip did for Cass, it's awesome, you know, because I thought he was beautiful in both those two episodes. And he's kind of exactly what the boys need to hear and have around them right now.
Yes.
You know, he's just...
He is being a little bit the angel on their shoulder almost, in a way, in a good way, to reflect back the good parts of themselves, of Sam and Dean's self to them. And I was out with a friend last night, and funnily enough, we were talking about Supernatural, and one thing we were saying was how, you know, some fans say, oh, look, every season there's, you know, there's conflict and then they get back together and, you know, same old, same old. And what we were both saying is how another, you know, part of the genius of the writing, though, is in the evolution of the characters. And so that, you know, that scene and certainly the scene with Cass and Sam, but that's Cass and Dean's scene. In the past, Dean would never have apologised. No. Dean would have been so angry at himself that he would have lashed out at Cass, or he wouldn't have spoken about it. But to actually take that moment to apologise without reservation, and, you know, he doesn't even really justify, you know, he says he's done wrong. And I think that, again, shows, you know, where Dean's come to, and that for all, you know, his own self-loathing and issues, you know, there's been another part of Dean that has evolved over time that does realise the effect he has on other people, and both the good and the bad. And I think in the past he wouldn't have even thought apologising would have, you know, meant anything. No, so I think now that he takes in that moment, takes the opportunity to do that, speaks a lot for, you know, the part of Dean that has grown and has become compassionate, mightn't be the right word I'm looking for, but certainly values the fact that he does have an impact on other people, and that can be for the good, you know, because if you don't think you can have a good impact on someone, why would you bother apologising? Because you would just go, well, I've done something terrible. Of course they're going to expect I've done something terrible. I always do. What's the point? So I thought that was...
Talk to him about that this week, it might be different.
Well, I think they're two sides of one coin, though. Yeah. I think that idea that the impact you have on people is bad, I mean, realising that you have an impact on people is about whether it's good or bad is something. I think you can be. If you have no sense of self or don't think you matter, then you don't think you have an impact on people. Mm. And so I think they are, and I'm, you know, again, drawing that long bow, but I do think that's speaking to the part of Dean that's evolved emotionally. You know, because I do, you know me, Amy, I'm not the most optimistic of people, but I do think there's somewhere better that Dean's going to end up emotionally.
And you know me, I'm so optimistic, it's ridiculous.
But I do believe, and I do see that Dean now is both more broken and more injured emotionally and psychically than he was 9 seasons ago, but there are parts of Dean, and particularly those parts that are about connecting with people, that have evolved in a positive way.
I actually think he's, even though he's so destitute emotionally at the moment, I actually think he's a stronger person than he's ever been.
Yeah.
And I think that the last, you know, like, well, obviously the last 9 seasons, but the last couple of seasons particularly have, or last season and this season, have seen such wonderful growth in that character that I actually see him as a much stronger person. And even though he's so devastated now and in, you know, such a dark emotional place, I actually see him as a much stronger person, and I actually see him as somebody who can deal with that a lot better now.
Yeah, I certainly feel more hopeful for where he could end up than than I would have, even back in, you know, seasons 4 or 5 and certainly seasons probably 6 and 7. Oh. But
what was the one where he was drinking constantly? What was that one? Was that 6? You always have to tell me. I can never remember.
Well, he's always been drinking. Well, 7 as well. He drank a lot because he was drinking on the job, remember?
Was that which one did Bobby die in? 7.
8.
8. God, see, I can never remember anything. That's so bad.
I remember we had the lovely line in near the end of season 8 where Cass makes that crack about are you in Sacrifice when Cass says, are you drinking on the job? And Dean says, what show have you been watching?
But see, that to me, there's drinking and drinking with Dean Winchester. If he's drinking whiskey, it's Bad News Bears. But if he's drinking beer, it's all okay.
I wouldn't necessarily say all okay,
well, you know,
but better.
It's more Deany. But, you know, like when he's drinking the whiskey, I think is when we've got really bad problems. So when I see him, like, boozing on the whiskey, I'm like, uh-oh, unless he's having, a nice drink at the Men of Letters bunker with Sam on the vintage stuff. But otherwise, I'm like, oh, we're in trouble. But when he's just having a few beers, it's just Dean to me. So, yeah, I think there's different levels of drinking for Dean, but he's always drinking, you're quite right.
So get back. We have Crowley with his wonderful shout out to Laverne and Shirley, which Crowley is turning into be even a bigger pop culture whore than Dean.
I just love him.
Crowley has spent a lot of his downtime in between wrecking havoc and making deals, watching TV, and God bless him for that. And well, I mean, we even found out this week that he's a Harry Potter fan.
I love him. He's fantastic.
And someone made a good point, I think, on a Tumblr post I saw that it's almost easy to take Mark Sheppard for granted, that he does what he does so well that it's almost a bit of familiarity breeds contempt. And that's overstating it. But I think sometimes, you know, you need to actually stop and look and remind yourself what an incredible job he's done with this character, and the chemistry he has with the people around him, and that he can be, you know, certainly as we've seen since the end of last season, introducing, you know, so much complexity and you know, Crowley having some connection with his own humanity, but you know, that he can turn from being, you know, incredibly dark and manipulative to being jokey and flirty, and you know, I certainly don't need to sell you. I know, Amy.
No, but, I know. I'm in love with him. I'm in love with Crowley. I'm a little bit in love with Mark Sheppard. No,
oh yes, who is he?
He's very charming. But I actually have to remind myself that he hasn't always been in the show. I have to remind myself that it was 5:10 that he came into it. And sometimes when rarely, because it's a very hard episode to watch, but sometimes when I go back and watch Abandon All Hope, I'm like, oh my God, you know, I'm really baffled that he has been in it for such a short amount of time, because he just feels like he's always been part of the story to me. And I think that really says something as well.
Yeah. And we have this then when he offers to go into Sam.
Oh.
Gadriel. You know, and it's one of those moments where you're thinking, oh, are you really, like, are you going to trust him? Because that is the thing. You never know with Crowley what long game he's playing, and you know, part of me is going,
he's always pretty straight up though, like, you don't know what his long game is. You're quite right, you don't know what the end game is of anything that he plans, but the immediacy of what he says he's going to do, he generally speaking sticks to that, but you don't know where that's going to go.
Except in the next episode when he spends the whole time deceiving Dean.
Well, yeah, but he never didn't say he wasn't lying to Dean.
Ooh, sins of omission, I think.
I love that too, though. I kind of halfway, oh, we should talk about that later, but I kind of halfway picked that when he was like shaking in his teacup, and I was like, come on, what? Stop that now. That looks wrong. And I was like, hang on a moment. And so when he came clean at the end, I was like, I knew it. Or when Dean picked it up anyway, but...
I didn't pick it up, except I did during the fight scene. That's where I'm thinking, hang on, Crowley, what's your game in not getting in and helping Dean at this point or doing something, even shouting encouragement. I thought, oh, there's something at play here, but I didn't know what it was. But anyway, getting back, this is one of probably many shout outs we should give to the work of the VFX team. First of all, in the whole putting needles into Jared's head, I think is one thing that needs a shout out, and Crowley's incredibly sexy red smoke, which gives me shivers.
I love his red smoke. I love that he has red smoke. I'm so glad that they wrote that. They wrote that in, didn't they? I'm so glad that was written into to the episode. What episode was that? The one where he possessed Mrs. Tran?
Yeah. I'll ask or go back and listen, because I'm pretty sure at the VFX event last year in Vancouver, it was their idea. It was a VFX crew's idea who contacted Carver and said, look, we're thinking of going with a different colour smoke for Crowley. I'll check up on that, but I'm pretty sure it came from the VFX mob.
Well, that was freaking genius because it was beautiful back then, but this was spectacular. And I keep actually seeing, speaking of Tumblr, little GIFs and little frames of it going through, and the beautiful, it's just absolutely, it's so gorgeous, and the shape that it takes as it twists through. It doesn't just go shooting through. It actually does this beautiful twisting motion
fluid.
Oh, but it's just wonderful.
And then we have this wonderful,
it's thick too. Crowley's got thick smoke. I don't know what that means, but you know, like he's got. Do you know what I mean? It's like it just feels really rich. His demon smoke. Loved it.
And then the great scene, of course, in inside Sam's head. Yeah. With Crowley, with everybody in Sam's head.
It was great, and you know, I love the connection between Crowley and Moose, for whatever reason that might be, but you know, I think obviously it comes back to the trials, and there seems to be, because even with Sam, he didn't doubt Crowley. He was like, what are you doing? You know, screaming for non-Dean who's getting a beer out of the kitchen.
Yeah.
But then Crowley's like, and he said, what is it? I can't even say it.
Poughkeepsie.
Thank you. And he's like, how do you know that word? But he trusted in Crowley. And I think there's a connection there that has forged from what they both went through in the trials, because I mean that they saw each other at their very lowest, both of them totally broken down. And yes. I think that can never really be ever forgotten. And
look, you know, going right back, I think there's always been a connection there, and I'm going to tag it as simple as I do think Crowley has a bit of a Sam crush. You know, he was the first one he gave a nickname to, and you know, I think there's something there.
Yeah, that's okay. We can all understand it. That's for sure. But the scene was wonderful, and what was great was that Crowley sort of said to Dean, you know, like, if it goes pear shaped, I'm getting out of there. But it went pear shaped, and he stayed and fought, and he fought, you know, for Sam essentially. And I was like, oh my god. So awesome. And it was such a great scene. And I really loved the moment where Sam popped his foot on Gadriel's
neck
and said, get out of me, you know. And you kind of sometimes forget how freaking badass and powerful, you know, Sam Winchester. You forget that because he's kind of quieter with his badassness. Yes. Dean's always running around with the big gruff voice and, you know, but...
Sometimes it's like he just unfurls the badassness.
Yeah,
it's like, oh fuck.
Yeah, and that was that moment. It was like, oh man, I always forget how rockin' you are. And I don't. I never forget that because I always think he's rocking. But you know what I mean. I always, you know, you kind of don't see that side of him that often because he's kind of the more thoughtful brother. And it was just wonderful. I just loved it.
And then we end up with, and again, back to the both Serge's cinematography and Bob Singer's directing, that gorgeous final scene on the pier, which just turn the sound down and look at it.
The lighting is
spectacular. It's a scene of three people talking, and it is just stunning. Apparently was actually pissing down with rain, which...
They must have covered them while they were shooting it. I'd love to hear about that, actually, because when you... I know it it looked like real rain, so I assumed it was pissing down Vancouver.
Apparently it was. Ryan from the VFX team says what he remembered most about that night was how hard it was raining. So, yes, they would have had a cover over them.
Yeah, they had a cover over them because the guys weren't getting wet.
Obviously the cameras too.
The cameras would have been in wet weather gear. The cameras would have been rugged up. But that scene is so beautifully shot. The lights going down the pier and then... it's just stunning, and if
a
you look at
the boat goes along behind them, and then at the end when the camera obviously on a crane,
beautiful crane
shot. You see Dean walk to the car. I do recommend fans just turn down the sound and watch that, because again, it's a hallmark of a show, you know, hitting above its weight in a way, mm-hmm. in a good way, because you know it just adds that level of, you know, sophistication to telling that story. Aside from just being lush to look at, but you know, we do have, you know, the classic boys sharing their feelings, but not in a good way.
Not in a good way.
Poor Cass has to walk down the...
Well, Cass was us. Cass was the audience. I mean, Cass was us watching.
It so reminded me, I mean, whatever analogy you want to use, whether it's a kid watching mum and dad fight or when you're out with friends of yours who are a couple who are fighting, and you sort of, like, you don't want them to fight, but you know it's not your place to intervene. And he's got that sort of...
he's very concerned and caring look. And I just looked at it and I was like, in that moment, Castiel was us watching two people he loves, you know, more than he possibly should, hurting each other because they hurt so much. And, you know, it was such a sad scene, but gosh, it was gorgeous. And on the watch it without the sound, I would also seek out some screen caps for it because it is stunning. It looks like a little piece of art. Each individual frame looks like a little piece of art.
And then, of course, we end with that, you know.
It's not the problem.
Dean walking away and Sam saying, you know, that's not, you know, the problem being, you know, Dean said it's because he's toxic and everyone around him dies. And that's so I think that's – it's interesting in a way because it wasn't – it was an interesting separation because Sam lets him go, but there's not a sense of don't ever darken my doorstep again. It's not – anger, you know, it's an interesting emotional place, I think, because Sam's certainly angry, but I think there's almost a sadness or something there as well. It's almost, you know, that he's sad that Dean can't see what the problem is.
I actually thought
as
Sam,
well as being pissed at him.
yeah, he's obviously pissed and he, you know, we knew he was going to be pissed, but he actually reacted very much how I thought he would, which was, you know, not with a lot of anger, but more just quiet disappointment and disillusionment. And but I think he was really disappointed that Dean, for me it read that he was disappointed that Dean was once again making a choice on behalf of the both of them and choosing to walk away. And there was a moment there when Sam's like, oh, what are you, you know, like his face was like, what are you doing? And I think, you know, Dean almost compounded it by, you know, just, and I know exactly where Dean Winchester's coming from because I know him better than I know most real people in my life. But, I just felt like he just completely compounded the problem in that moment for Sam, and the problem being choice, you know, and having these...
Again, taking choice away from...
And he took that choice right away from Sam, the choice of, do you want to, you know, talk it through? Do you want to fight it out? Do you want to come with me? Do you want to help get retribution? He took everything away from Sam in that moment, and, you know, that's what Sam... I just don't think that's the problem. And you saw in Sam's face, like, I can't even believe you're doing this again. You know, he just looked incredulous at Dean, and Dean can't see it because... I think there's a bunch of reasons Dean can't see it, but, you know, in that moment he's in such a horrific emotional place and just feels so down on himself and so poisonous that, you know, he has to walk away. But I think there's a lot of reasons that Dean struggles to see Sam's point of view on how he treats Sam.
So then, of course, we again pretty much go straight into the next episode, having spent a week going, what's going to happen together? And we ended up with a whole, you know, a whole episode with the boys separated, which is a rare event.
Second.
There's only been a few
time.
Episodes
no,
where
they're back.
Yeah, where they've physically been apart.
Completely
but we
apart with nothing. It's only the second one.
Okay. And, you know, we had the delight, in a way, though, of having, you know, Sam hanging out with the angel, Dean hanging out with the demon, so a reverse of season four, if you like, and just to get to see, you know, it was such a great character episode to get to see the dynamic and what being with different people reveals about the characters. So to have Dean with Crowley and, of course, Kane, but also to have Sam and Cass together, I think was it was amazing to watch, and as I said, it revealed so much about all those characters.
But I also think it seems to be like a bit of a theme of the season is that the characters on the outside of the relationship reflecting back the relationship, and we've talked about this before, I know, we're reflecting back the personalities and the issues of the brothers, but also the brothers' relationship to them. And I think Crowley and Castiel both did that with Sam and Dean, in both reflecting back to them personal issues that the brothers are dealing with themselves, but also issues around their relationship or how their relationship is really seen from the outside, which the brothers can't see because they're too full of hurt and stupid assness.
It's a different way that, you know, season four played out, really, where, you know, the relationships that developed between Dean and Cass and also between Sam and Ruby in large part happened because the other brother was absent, and not just to say those characters were just space fillers, but they were emotionally providing what, you know, Dean wasn't for Sam and Sam wasn't for Dean. So I think it's a different function than they're playing this season, but a nice parallel or mirror, I think, of that. Of course, I don't know how long Dean and Crowley could hang out. I mean, even Crowley's manipulations aside, I think Dean would end up spending a lot of time punching Crowley, mainly because, like, Crowley's the antithesis of Sam in that nothing bothers Crowley in terms of Dean can't say anything that's going to get up Crowley's nose.
No, so not at like, all.
You know, the lines Crowley can keep, you know, like there was the reference to your daddy's man cave, and the week, what was it, the week before, calling the Impala your phallus on wheels.
I know, but it totally like, is.
Crowley just continuing to, you know, bait Dean,
and
almost
also
in a way that Dean does to Sam, like it's a sort
yes.
of, it's still got that sense of a familiar relationship, except Dean doesn't buy into it. I mean, Dean doesn't ever let his guard down.
No, he doesn't with Crowley. But I also really like that Crowley says all these, is that your boudoir, you know, was that your boudoir eyes or whatever he says to him at the bar. I mean, he does all these little flirty things with Dean too that just totally throws Dean for a loop. He just really can't deal with flirty Castiel, flirty Crowley at all, flirty Castiel. Where was I going with that one?
Well, I think it's also because Dean won't let himself or relax or on
no,
anything.
He won't let him get
around Crowley as well. He hates Crowley. He's engaging with Crowley for the reason that Crowley's engaging with him, which is
they're
pragmatism.
Using each other. Yep.
And you know, really in Dean's case at this moment, lack of a better option, you know, as Crowley points out, you know, he's got no leads on Gadriel. He needs to kill shit. Abaddon's on the list, so, you know, why not work with him? You know, which is obviously very different than the relationship between Cass and Sam. Although, again, you know, you get this sense with, you know, Cass is like, you know, wanting Sam to call Dean. But I keep thinking, well, you know, Cass, why don't you call Dean?
Well, this is true, but I think no one wants to step, you know, I think you look at their relationship, would you want to step in the middle of that one?
Oh no, and I certainly understand that, and I think Cass probably knows it would not
be helpful. And
well, also I don't know that Cass has the knowledge of how relationships and humans work still to know whether that would, or even to think of doing that. I mean, I can accept that Cass isn't on the phone to Dean because anyone in that situation would find it hard, let alone Castiel, who is still, despite his sort of evolution of his humanity, is still grappling with those things.
Yeah.
So we do. Why don't we just talk about the, I suppose, the Sam Cass part of the story to start, which was, so we have him offering or suggesting that, you know, they find the men of letters thought that maybe using an angel's grace could be used as a locator, and just, I suppose, on the mythology side of things, that makes sense because they do have that big table in the war room that was rigged up that all lit up when the angels fell to earth. So there's obviously the men of letters, for whatever reasons, put a lot of effort into tracking angels and trying to think of how to follow them, which fascinates me because, why were they so interested in angels and how did they even know, given that, Sam and Dean didn't even know angels were real for most of their life, what was the interaction the men of letters had with angels that meant that they developed technology and were trying to find ways to track them? So
they obviously knew about them. Had they met a bunch of them, or, you know, like, exactly. I mean, Sam and Dean kind of, I mean, I kind of always assumed before the men of letters that the reason the angels came into play was to stop the apocalypse and to get Dean out of hell. And that's how we ended up with angels on our doorsteps. But, you know, the men of letters certainly implies that there's a much bigger picture with angels and that they've known about them for a longer time.
So that, that one's in the bank for future exploration, I think. And then we have in terms of a hurt comfort narrative, it probably ticks all the boxes because here you have Cass doing something to Sam, which is incredibly painful, but he's doing it to be helpful, and he's also very caring about, you know, Sam's well-being during this, as you know, Sam, of course, feeling the weight of that he sees himself as being responsible for Kevin's death and wanting to do anything cancel that out or to
balance it.
Yes, and I just thought those scenes were incredibly intense.
They were so intense that I couldn't even appreciate Jared lying on a chair fully stretched out in a V-neck T-shirt all tied around his until the second watch.
Amy, oh my God.
I couldn't appreciate it until the second watch. It was all too much for me.
Oh dear.
I know. That says something for the acting.
It says a lot, and I think, you know, Jared, again, as you know, he really has throughout the season, you know, went to a place of incredible vulnerability for Sam and a complex emotion too. It's not just, you know, it's not just a suicide wish, or it's, you know, it's genuine regret and sadness, and it's a desire to want to do right, which, you know, is very, you know, Sam Winchester. We've always seen.
Which he even said, you know, please help me to do this one thing, you know, right. You know, he just baffles me. He just feels like he's done so much bad. And this is the lovely connection through Cass and Sam, which I think we've all been waiting for. Come on, guys, you know, have a conversation, because you have both always tried to do the right thing and have always sort of ended up, you know, putting your foot in it. And I think everybody has waited for this conversation for such a long time between them. But yeah, it's a tragedy of Sam that I think he feels like he has to atone for all this stuff that really he doesn't really have to atone for.
Yeah, I don't know that it's necessarily a tragedy, because I'd prefer him to feel like that than not feel like that. Because I think if he, you know, the other extreme of that is him going, well, yes, I was possessed and it wasn't my fault. I think Cass...
The heartbreaking, I should say.
Yeah, heartbreaking. Cass got to the nub of it when he said, why are you Winchesters always so ready to rush towards death? Which I think is something Bobby said to Dean back way back in the season two finale after he'd made the deal. what was it, why, you and your daddy so ready to throw yourself into the pit.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, I think that is a Winchester tragedy, is, you know, their preparedness isn't the right word, but
willingness.
There's something where their desire to punish themselves gets tied up with their desire to do good. And I think that's part of the tragedy, that they get those two things so mixed up that, they think they should be punished. And thinking you're responsible for a terrible thing and trying to fix it is a separate thing from wanting to punish yourself for having done that terrible thing. But for the Winchesters, it's always tied up together. We have to mention the whole PB&J scene, or as Misha called it, the P&BJ scene, which I don't even know what the P stands for in that. I know what the BJ stands for. That's blowjob, in case anyone didn't get Misha's humour. I just thought I'd be explicit with that because people ask me this stuff all the time. They do. Not everyone's rude like Misha. And we did get asked on Twitter today about our opinion on grape jelly. And Amy and I have no opinion because we're Australian and we actually have fruit in our breakfast spreads. We have marmalade or we have jam. Jelly is what you have if you have no teeth or you're very ill in bad hospital.
You're in a hospital.
And that's the other sort of jelly. We don't have jelly in a jar. Well, we probably do, but
I don't even think we do. But anyway.
We
eat stuff like Vegemite that likes to take the roof, the roof of your mouth off.
Maybe, they could have Vegemite as a villain in a Supernatural episode, I think. And, in fact, I was just alerted to the fact that Canada today has just banned Marmite because it's got so much bad shit in it. For those who don't know, Marmite is the English equivalent of Vegemite, another thing made from the scrapings of the bottom of a beer brewing barrel. But that's a podcast for another show altogether,
really. It's a yeast podcast.
Oh no, now we're going to the
I don't like it.
So yes, but that was the lovely metaphor used in the episode. Cass eating the sandwich, which he enjoyed as a human, and now he could actually, taste, as he says, every molecule of it, but
not the sum of its parts.
I think his reflections of I thought that was a really lovely, eloquent, elegant metaphor for, the difference for him between being human and being angelic. And the fact that I liked the callback to, the fact that he did experience death and that he realised what that meant. And that also, again, here he can, he doesn't want Sam to kill himself, and that he says, in the past also he would have pushed on and done whatever it took to, complete the mission, if you like, in a very Winchester-esque way. But, but he decides not to. He decides to stop.
Yay, Cass.
Now, whether we're going to see any further implications of that, I'm not sure, other than the fact that they didn't get the location spell to work. But,
but he healed. He healed all the grace out of Sam, or at least he said he did.
Yes, I suppose the part of me which has been trained by supernatural writers to be paranoid and suspicious of even the most simple scene was immediately thinking, is there some part of Cass that's taken some of that leftover grace into himself? Because remember, he's got stolen grace, which is possibly a bit dodgy.
I read it as him going, I'm not going to do this and I'm not going to take it any further. Like, there's more grace in Sam to take out, but I'm not going to take it because to take that is going to kill Sam or revert him back to how he was, after the trials, which is essentially to kill Sam. And I'm not going to do that, so I'm just going to take what I've got and I'm going to heal it, and Sam's not going to have, choice is going to be taken away from him again. Sam's not going to have any kind of knowledge of this. I'm just going to do this. And that's kind of how I read it. I read it as him just looking at the PB&J and going, you know, this has gone too far. I'm taking what we've got. If it works, it works. Everything else is getting healed out. And I hope that's what it meant, because that's how I read it. And yes. I was like, yay, Cass!
Oh, no, and I do overall think that's it. Well, I do totally agree with you. As I said, there was just that part of me that's been trying to go, what's the really worst scenario?
Well, I'm still thinking, like, when he punched Gadriel in the face, I was like, ooh, is that the, you know, like the stolen grace is like evil or something? Because, like, he had that little look at the end. So I'm the same. I'm doubting everything at every corner. We're Supernatural fans, of course we do.
Of course, the end, you know, we've got Cass. Oh, of course, we can't not mention the hug, of course, given that so many episodes ago, Sam refused to hug Cass. So it was a sign of how far their relationship's come.
But it was so awkward. It's just wonderful.
And, you know, because we do have a page of all the hugs in the whole show on the Super Wiki, except for that one hug from Dean in Purgatory and Cupid, Cass hasn't ever been hugged, so he is very unfamiliar with the hug and the etiquette of the hug, I think.
And that was the first hug for the season.
It was. I know. I haven't even updated the graph yet. I'll have to wait and see. But, you know, we had a hug orgy last season. It was hugging left, right,
center. A hug-a-thon. It was wonderful.
I'll go with hug orgy. so this is the first one we've had. Very stingy this season with the hugs. They must have used up the contract's worth of hugs last season. So, but then, you know, and you again we end with Cass you know, sort of, oh, you can ring Dean about now, it'd be really helpful, Sam, and Sam sort of,
nah,
you know, no, I'll be
he
fine.
He walked away, we'll be good. Shut up.
Okay, so then moving on to what was really the main show, which was Dean and Crowley with Kane, played by the absolutely wonderful Timothy Onmadson. And his beard.
I think his beard got a separate credit.
I'm debating whether we need a wiki entry just on his beard. I'm currently writing one on the guinea pig.
I love the guinea pig.
The guinea pig, which doesn't exist, but I think that needs to go in the pet section on the wiki.
Wow, is there anything else? Oh, yeah, well, I suppose there's all those dogs that have been killed. In the name,
yes, Buffins has an entry of on the wiki already, or a bowl of Muffins' blood does. You know, when you have Crowley saying that's the father of murder, I mean, what a brilliant phrase.
Beautiful
and,
line.
The whole image of Cain in the beekeeping suit. Crowley getting buzzed by the CGI bee was gorgeous.
But it was a good CGI bee, not like those CGI bees that were in that, what was the episode with James Masters and Dr. Phil. Oof, they were the worst CGI bees I've ever seen in my life, so at least these were good ones. I was like, oh, yay, a good bee. Oh, my gosh. Anyway, sorry, I digress.
But, you know, wonderful opening up of the mythology. And, you know, we've had Cain and Abel mentioned a couple of times as, you know, just generally referred to. But obviously a part of religious mythology that makes sense to bring into the show because it's about two brothers. So what did you think of that, Amy?
I loved it. I absolutely loved how they changed up the mythology. So that instead of making it that Cain killed his brother because he was jealous, because he was God's favourite, which is the biblical, well, the straight out biblical. There's many, many different interpretations of the Cain and Abel story, because I know this because I have been Wikipediaing like crazy straight after the episode, straight on Wikipedia. But, you know, the traditional telling of it is that, you know, they had to bring gifts for God, Cain's was rejected, so Cain killed Abel out of jealousy. But I love that they turned it around to be that Cain killed Abel in order to save his soul. And save
interesting,
his soul.
I will just butt in. There's a couple of, because the story appears in the Quran, the Torah, and in the Old Testament, and also, and it's also a, what would you say, a folkloric story through a lot of the Middle East. And there's another version of it in which Cain and Abel both have twin sisters.
Oh.
And to stop, I'll say incest in inverted commas, they're commanded to marry the other's twin sister, and Abel doesn't want Cain to marry his sister, and that's what brings about, it's basically jealousy that brings about the murder. So and in another story, Cain ends up, after he has killed Abel and been sort of exiled by God, ends up being the father of two-headed monsters in purgatory.
Which is fascinating.
So, yeah, so there's a whole lot of versions there. But, of course, you know, as you say, wonderful reinterpretation by the show here that really – more, you know, even more parallel Sam and Dean's situation, because you have Cain really sacrificing himself to save his brother.
Yeah, which is very much in line with what the brothers do, you know, and certainly what Dean has already done, really. But the whole saving the soul from Lucifer and the tie to Lucifer, the younger brother tied to Lucifer and the older brother, you know, I mean, it was, I think it's a beautiful twist that they've done, and it really opens up really kind of scary possibilities. I mean, I said to you before we actually recorded this that I was really scared at the end of this episode, and I can't remember the last time I felt so frightened about, you know, the trajectory of the brothers and where they're going and what this Cain and Abel thing and what this Mark of Cain thing means and even just twisting the mythology like they have, which I think is absolutely fabulous, but it also fills me with, you know, dread.
Yeah. Yeah. So what, you know, so Cain mentions there's a burden or a cost associated with the mark in a lot of the mythology I read about it, the mark meant that people weren't allowed to kill Cain. So it could be the burden of, you know, which in a way they have the burden of not being high, but, you know, it could be the burden of, you know, living and killing forever, you know. We just, you know, we don't know. And, of course,
what was the other one? Walking the earth as a nomad estranged from your family.
Yes. And we do know that, of course, after Cain was marked by Lucifer, you know, he became the head of the Knights of Hell.
Yeah.
Which, you know, he's presented as being someone who's meant to be a sympathetic character and a good person. You know, he sacrificed himself for his brother. But, you know, he obviously
embraced
was
it.
Someone that Dean would believe Crowley is scared of, that was committed, you know, carnage across the earth. And he obviously agrees to give the mark to Dean because he sees something of himself in Dean, which is scary enough.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, he obviously, you know, and Dean's had those times like in hell where he gave in to the torture, and then he's admitted, you know, that he enjoyed it. And then you see Cain has created the Knights of Hell, and there's just these really uncomfortable parallels, I think, between the characters and just the whole Mark of Cain thing is just so scary, really. And, you know, he's not going to tell Sam about it. Like, he's just going to pull down that sleeve when he finally gets back with Sam.
I mean, I think that's going to, well, there's obviously a lot the boys have to work out, but you know, it's interesting now how really, you know, we've got Dean lined up to go after Abaddon, we've got Sam lined up to go after Gadriel and Metatron.
Which is kind of interesting to me because, you know, Dean wasn't kind of in the I'm going to go after Abaddon sort of, he was going after Gadriel, you know, and Gadriel, I see he has issues with Gadriel. I can understand, you know, we need to get rid of Abaddon and there's issues there as well. But you know what I mean? There was like this revenge story of him going after Gadriel, and then now he's kind of on the Abaddon bandwagon. And
I suppose we'll have to see. I mean, again, you know, going back to the fact that he had no leads on where Gadriel was.
Yeah, true.
You know, Sam's got the advantage of having an angel on his side in Castiel, who might be able to find out something. And I assume that once they get back together, those missions may merge, because really they, you know, they still both want the same thing in terms of, you know, revenge on Gadriel. And you know, I think they're both also pragmatic enough to know that they're better off having Crowley in charge of hell than Abaddon, although that is I don't know that the devil, you know, is better.
at least he's a little bit more organized.
Well, I think also, well, and I have been dismayed by the number of people who are on Team Crowley, because they think he's the softer, gentler demon. But I do agree that Crowley's probably less likely to kill you first.
Yes. He will look at what you can do for him before he'll just straight out kill you.
Yes.
And so you've probably got, I think
your odds are slightly better, but let's face it.
Oh, he is what he is, and at some point in time, we're going to see him go back to being what he was before. I mean, he's at the moment now, he's kind of this, I keep calling him the frenemy, you know, he's like this, they know he's bad news bears, but they can, you know, they're using him for what they need to use him for, and vice versa. And but at some point, that relationship is going to go back to what it was before, I think. And
well, and it was, I did think it was, again, and then, you know, Cain had called Dean very well, was, you know, at the end when Dean's going, after this is over, I'm going to kill you. I kept thinking, Dean, remember Crowley could kill you first.
I think you need to,
you know, he is quite a bit more powerful than you, Dean, and he can zap away and zap in, and he could kill you very quickly. I hope we see Cain again very soon.
I do too, and I feel really optimistic from, well, I was like, because he didn't die, I was like, wait a minute, he can't die. So, I mean, he still had the mark, and I know a lot of people were kind of going, oh, he transferred his mark to Dean, but when you see him fighting the demons in his house, he pushes up his sleeve and the mark's still there. So,
and well, whatever he's, you know, the way he was able to kill all those demons, and we saw again wonderful VFX. Can I say VFX effect? A wonderful visual effect of the red light inside the house as he's killing them all. You know, so he's obviously very powerful without the first blade anyway, so
yeah, he's got some kind of amazing powers there. But and a lot of people I know have been wondering if some of those powers will transfer to Dean, but I personally just think the mark will allow him to carry the blade, but it'll also come with some other burden.
Yes. Well, and it's like, you know, and if you do carry the blade, what does that mean? And we know, you know, Dean's been to that very dark killy place before, torturey killy place before, and that's obviously a concern, that it can open up that, you know, darkness that, you know, was released, if you like, when he was, you know, tortured in hell to almost the point of becoming a demon himself. Let's not forget that. So,
Oh God, it was awesome. And I can't not end, because you have specifically told someone that I will discuss Dean's Wrangler beard.
I'd be disappointed if you did. Go on, Amy. One of the highlights of the episode.
The highlights of the episode with Dean's Wrangler beard. Actually, the highlights of the episode, many, but I have to say that Dean wears Dark Dean particularly well, and yes, the beard. So I think he should stay a little bit scruffy for a while. And I've always been particularly partial to the fact that Jensen's grows the big Wrangler beard, which I think is really awesome. And Dean, it was so ginger. It was awesome. In case you don't know what we're talking about, people not from Australia, a Wrangler beard is a ginger beard.
Yes. A red beard. A Wrangler tang. That's where ranger comes from. We don't call them gingers in Australia. We call them rangers. Because they're even ruder than everyone else in the world.
and I do love it. And I think we should also talk about that fight scene because it was spectacular.
Oh, all Jensen.
All Jensen, all the time. But not only that, it was such a beautifully choreographed scene in such a tight space.
Oh, yes.
And I thought that was absolutely spectacular. And I was really blown away when I heard that it was Jensen. And then I went back and really watched it. I was like, oh, yeah, you can see it's Jensen all the time. But I would be interested to know how long they had to rehearse that scene because it was really beautiful. It was like a dance.
Well, so. I think Tim Omundsen tweeted at the time it took them 9 hours to film
it. 9 hours to film. I know. He said he'd watched Jensen fighting for 9 hours, which is so awesome.
I don't know the total length of time, but that's – I wonder how he felt, given that he was just sitting there shucking corn.
I know. And Jensen's like rolling all over the table.
You'd be thinking, gee, I've earned the easier paycheck today.
Awesome. I wonder if Jensen hurt the next day.
I think you'd have to.
Yeah, I think you'd have to.
I don't think there's any way out of the fact that it was an incredibly physical performance. I mean, that wasn't just sort of swaying to the side to look like someone's punched you. I mean, that was tossing himself onto tables.
Yeah, well, they picked him up and threw him on that table.
Yeah, so if that's all Jensen, I would say there would be would have at the very least been a few aches and pains, if not bruises, after that. But yeah, wonderful piece of work, and I'm sure from Lou Bolo, the stunt coordinator,
beautifully choreographed in that as well.
One other thing I wanted to mention, which I'm still struggling to articulate, so everyone, including Amy, bear with me. One of the things I felt about this episode, which I think was universally lauded. I think it was an instant fan favourite. Would you agree?
I would agree. I don't think I've seen anybody say anything other than wonderful, glowing things about it, and that's rare these days.
We're rare any time. There was something that struck me about the episode, and I think it applies to Supernatural overall. I think it particularly applies possibly to Robbie Thompson's writing. And I think you don't notice it as much in an episode like Slumber Party because that was particularly taking, you know, the Oz mythology and playing with it. But there was, and this is where I get into not being able to put words together very well, it reminded me of a comic in the way that the mythology was almost, I don't want to say bigger than the story, but it felt, I don't know, you know, if you're a comics reader, that often you dive into a story and bits of the mythology grow or get revealed along the way. I've been reading this Saga comic series by Brian Vaughan and Fiona Staples where, you know, you dive into these almost surreal worlds and characters. And the mythology works. It's all about character, but the mythology is there, and I'm probably not making any sense. But this episode, which was very, supernatural mythology heavy, there was a lightness about it too, but also is it magic realism? You know, the idea that you have, you know, here's Cain, the father of murder, who's a beekeeper. Here's the king of hell, sticking out his pinky as he has a cup of tea. You know, here's Cain shucking corn while, you know, Dean's fighting demons. And then you've got an angel sucking angel grace out of a guy who grew up on demon's blood. I know I'm on the sense at the moment, but there's something stylistically in that. And maybe magic realism's a good word for it, but maybe people who read comics will sort of get what I'm sort of getting at.
It would make sense because if you look at the people who are working on the show, you know, there's some pretty strong comic writers going on there.
Yeah, and it's just something I'd either not thought of. I need to go back and I need to think about what I'm trying to say as well.
Yeah. But no, that's very interesting.
Part of that was certainly this episode with John Badham directing, who was,
oh,
I thought,
my God.
Amazing.
Amazing.
And maybe that's because of the strong frames he gave us. So you think of this episode, if you just think back now, there's some images that will instantly pop into your head. You know, Castiel with the PB&J Castiel, getting the grace out of Sam, Kane
shucking
corn,
which Crowley was interesting actually, because in the Christian Kane mythology around Kane in Christianity is that he can no longer grow crops,
yeah,
because he was a farmer and you know, when he bled his brother into the soil, it meant it poisoned the soil for him for all time, so he can no longer grow crops. So I actually thought that was interesting. He had to go into he had to go into town to buy some vegetables.
So anyway, that's my reasonably incoherent rave, which I need to go and read a whole lot about storytelling in comics, I think, to articulate those thoughts. But I felt that feeling in my waters again that the show's lifted up to another level again. There's a and maybe that's to do with opening the mythology up yet again, that there's a lightness about, you know, it's not bound by, you know, one part of the mythology storyline. So now we've got the whole Men of Letters history. We've got what we've always had going on with the angels and the demons. Now we've got this other thread from you know, from Kane, and that it feels, you know,
big.
Yes, things are opening up without them just, it's not like they're just chucking things in, they're still coherent.
I wasn't as eloquent. I said that the show just turned it up to 11.
Thank you. You've probably said in half a dozen words what I've just been struggling to say, but I would be interested if anyone listening to this is a bit more of a comics, because I'm, you know, I would not call myself a comics aficionado. I'm a very casual comics reader, but I love, you know, it is a different form of storytelling, and there's something about, I think, the way the show is using the mythology at the moment that feels like, you know, and for those who don't read comics, they may think that's pejorative, but it's the highest compliment I can give, in a way that it's big and playful, and allowing the story to go where it wants to go without being tied down, you know, to one sort of very literal bit of mythology.
It feels very big. I can only imagine that the guys must be super excited to play this kind of thing.
Well, yes, and you know, have a guest actor like Omidson on the show, who
or
I know
a guest is not, director like John Badham.
John Badham, yes, who and I did think so. Back in Girl with a Dungeon and Dragon Tattoo, there are some War Games jokes, and of course, John Badham was the director of War Games. The
Pac-Man
movie.
Fever too. And Dean says to Charlie, "Okay, War Games."
Yes, but Bobby Thompson. So I am absolutely sure that when he wrote those episodes, and he's obviously a big fan of the movie, that he never thought that he'd have the director of that movie directing an episode of his. So that must have been a particular thrill. So I assume, winding this up, that the boys will probably be back together soon next week.
Next week.
Somehow. Somehow, I'm obviously, this is supernatural, so we know that their issues won't all just be fixed with a quick hug and a shoulder punch. But why? Yes, I know, Amy, that you just want them to go, oh, it's all forgotten.
I love you, Sam. I love you, Dean.
I know you mean well, bro.
Exactly.
Let's get back in the Impala and kill some monsters.
Woohoo!
Kill some sons of bitches and have some pie. We should finish by saying it was Dean Winchester's birthday on the 24th of January. No one knows the fuck how old Dean Winchester is anymore.
I'm just choosing to go with the current age of 35 because, you know, the show seems to be a bit ropey about that itself. So, but yes, who knows? A couple of years forward, you know, who knows?
Also, poor dead Jessica's birthday. I never like to forget that, although you can't really say happy birthday to a dead person. So that was the week that was. Anything in conclusion, Amy?
No, I'm really excited. did. Like, I got really scared at the end of this episode. I feel the whole Mark of Cain thing is very frightening, but I think it's super exciting. And you know, as much as I kind of go, oh my God, where's this going? I go, oh my God, where's this going? So it's in two voices. So I'm really excited. And yeah, no, I just can't wait for next week. Like, I am literally finding every single week more than ever. I'm going, oh my God, come on, come on, come on. And poor Jules and I, we have to work all day and wait till we get home.
It is difficult. I'm glad to see both last week and this week. Again, we had heaps of the cast and crew tweet live tweeting.
I'm hoping we get that Gents in Shackles guy soon.
Well, I think he was actually filming this week.
He was working. I don't know.
So Jared was home, so yeah. He managed to tweet. But
I love that they tweet. It's absolutely fabulous.
Oh, absolutely. It's like having a live episode commentary. Well, it is a live episode commentary each week. It's also hilarious.
I have to say my favourite tweet was Misha saying that something was pushing into his hip in that hug. I laughed out loud. I was like, oh my gosh, he's so awesome. But even and wasn't Orlando playing on it again this week?
I guess Orlando Jones of Sleepy Hollow live tweeted again this week with his amazing meme and gif ability, and he's been an absolute delight to have on board. So you can catch, I've storified all those tweets, and they're on the episode pages on the wiki. So if you're doing a rewatch, you can pull those up and have a read. There's some great behind the scenes stuff, yeah, as well as a lot of trash talk.
Yeah, a lot of trash talk.
So we'll be back sometime in the near future. Hopefully by then we will have a season 10 confirmation. Otherwise,
let's hope we get early renewal. I'm hoping for early renewal before I go to Vegas Con.
Yes. That would be
5 days.
That would be wonderful. So yeah. That's what date is that, Amy?
March 12th. Oh, so no, March 12th is when I fly. March 13th, it starts.
Oh, good. You've got a whole half an hour before the con after you land, have you?
No, I've got a day. I land on the Wednesday. It starts on the Thursday.
Okay. And of course, that's the first con for the Woo-hoo! Year.
4 days. The first ever 4 day con.
And the first ever 4 day con, which may possibly lead to a high mortality rate amongst mm-hmm. both guests and fans. I think
I'm worrying for Richard.
Well, we'll talk more about that as it gets closer and certainly afterwards. Thank you very much for listening and watching Supernatural in ever-increasing numbers. Yay. And we'll see you soon.
Bye-bye. Watch a horror movie right there on my TV. Horror movie.